Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. Mungo McCallum is back on Conversations today. Mungo is, of course, a writer and journalist who's been writing about politics since the 1960s. And if we're being completely honest, it's fair to say that Mungo had some strong reservations about the previous government and its leader, John Howard. Mungo's had some harsh things to say about them in print over the years. But since he was last here in 2006, the world's turned over several times. And there's a new Prime Minister, new premiers in Queensland and New South Wales, several in New South Wales, in fact, and the Liberals have had four leaders in 3 years. But at a deeper level, Mungo thinks the ideas that have sustained the left and right of politics have also been turned over. He's fascinated by the rise of Kevin Rudd, and in the latest quarterly essay, he asks the question, quote, "What is it about this repetitive, boring, God-bothering nerd that appeals to the proverbially laid-back, cynical, disengaged public?" His quarterly essay is called Australian Story, Kevin Rudd and the Lucky Country. Hello, Mungo.
Oh, g'day, Richard.
You're a bit banged up. Your arm's not good.
Yes. I like to say I ran into Tony Abbott in a back alley, but in fact I slipped over on some wet rocks. dramatic.
Oh, dear. And how badly banged up is your arm?
Oh, I smashed the right shoulder quite badly, but, you know, so it goes. Fortunately, I'm left-handed. Just I'm going to have to learn to drink left-handed as well as everything else.
So you won't be able to drink a schooner with the right hand from now on?
No, it doesn't look like it. I could pour it into my ear, but I couldn't really get it up to my mouth.
So how did you write your quarterly essay then?
Well, single-handed, as they say.
Tapping away with one hand.
Tapping away with one hand, yes. I'd had to do the last 5,000 words after I had the break, and it was, you know, it was a pretty messy piece of typing, I've got to admit.
During the 2007 election campaign, I saw footage of you on Melbourne Cup Day during that campaign having a beer with Kevin Rudd. Did you like him?
Oddly enough, I did, and I'm practically unique among Australian journalists in that regard, as far as I can tell. I find him, when he's not talking about politics, which admittedly isn't very often, but when he isn't, I find him a most engaging companion, you know, funny, laid back, interesting. And there's no doubt at all that he has got the fire in the belly. That's something that doesn't come across in his public persona so much, and it's one of the reasons I had my doubts about him for a long time before he became leader. But when you get down to it, the fire is there, the passion is there, and Kevin Rudd in that sense is very much an engaged, switched-on Labor man, which again is an impression he doesn't give so often.
I heard one sort of senior political journalist say to me that Kevin Rudd invented a personality for himself to win the 2007 election to make him presentable to the Australian people, and he's going to have to learn to become more his authentic self. This is a journey probably many leaders go on as they shift from being election winner to people in government.
Oh, well, all politicians have to have multiple approaches. I mean, obviously, you put on a different personality when you're having a beer with the voters in the pub to the one when you're being statesmanlike and talking to an international audience. I mean, this is part of the deal. But I don't think that there is all that much phoniness about Rudd, and nor it appears does the general public, because one of the things that struck me when I was writing this essay was earlier this year, a letter writer to one of the Sydney papers was trying to tackle this thing about what is it about Rudd that makes him so popular and for so long and so consistently. And she said, well, actually, it's just one word, integrity. Kevin Rudd has integrity. And I think in a funny sort of way, this is what the commentators and the journalists have missed, that they're so busy looking for normal political reasons for his popularity that they've missed the obviously more human one.
He's also lucky. It seems to be a lucky man in many ways, which most successful leaders are. Well, he won on Cup Day, didn't he?
Well, he won on last Cup Day. Yeah, on the 2007 Cup Day, yes, he backed efficient.
Yes.
Which was not bad, but that was only because his first pick was scratched, I might say. But as a Prime Minister, you could hardly call him lucky. I mean, he's no sooner elected than the whole economic world falls to bits. the global financial crisis strikes, he's got to forget about all his basic reform program and concentrate on saving the economy.
Now, in that, you write in your essay, he's firmly within the tradition of Labor prime ministers. What is it about this country? Labor prime ministers don't win government often. When they do, almost within a month or so, a major international crisis lobs on their doorstep.
It does seem to happen, doesn't it, right from the beginning when Andrew Fisher won government and the First World War immediately intervened. Then Jimmy Scullin won government and the Great Depression struck. Gough Whitlam won government and the oil crisis hit the Western world. And now Kevin Rudd. I don't know. You can't say. I don't think they actually cause it. They would certainly deny it. But on the other hand, Bob Hawke took office and immediately the drought ended, and he'd had no hesitation taking credit for that.
That's true. You look at Kevin Rudd and Australian political traditions and Australian history. Do you see Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister within a whole lot of Australian traditions, or is he a kind of a break? Is he something new in political leadership?
No, I don't think he is something new. The only thing that makes him interesting in that regard is that he's probably our first post-Cold War Prime Minister. He's the first Prime Minister who really can say that the important parts of his views were not formed in the context of the nuclear standoff between Russia and America. And I think that perhaps gives him a less cluttered perspective and a slightly less paranoid perspective than some of our leaders in the past, which can only be a good thing. But outside that, I think he's very firmly in the Australian tradition, and in particular in the tradition of the Australian Labor Party. And I think Kevin Rudd is very conscious of that tradition, and is reclaiming it and reinventing it in the wake of what John Howard's idea of Australia was. And I think, again, although he's doing it fairly subtly, he's not standing on a soapbox and ranting about it. But I think that's getting through to the public generally. And that, again, is something I think the commentariat has generally missed.
He campaigned during the 2007 election as an economic conservative. He had an ad with him sitting in something that looked like a boardroom and saying, "I'm an unashamed economic conservative." Yet since taking office, he's governed as a Keynesian, as it said, a man who's spent an enormous amount of money in order to jumpstart an ailing economy. You don't see a contradiction there, though, do you?
No, I don't, because I think it depends what you mean by a conservative. Okay, he's a conservative. He's not a neoliberal. He's not one of those people who says that you must never, under any circumstances, have debt or deficit as part of your budget strategy. And nor do conservative economists. I mean, you say he's a Keynesian, but the Keynesian approach is pretty much the conservative approach. I mean, Rudd said he would keep the budget in balance over the economic cycle, by which he meant, of course, in the good times he'd have surpluses and in the bad times he wasn't afraid to go into deficit. The balance would be restored over the cycle. And that's precisely how he's attacked the global financial crisis. The radical thing to do would have been to take the neoliberal approach and say, "Oh, we've got to cut spending to match the cuts in revenue. We can't do anything about that. If everybody starves in the street, bad luck. But the economy has to be kept in balance." And that, to me, would have been absolutely disastrous.
Yeah, Munger, he enrages his enemies, like all good prime ministers should, enrages them with what seems to them to be rank hypocrisy. On the one hand, he did campaign as an economic conservative. That's to the general public, where he wrote an essay for the Monthly magazine, you know, deploring Howard's Brutopia, the cruel neoliberal nightmare he'd led us into, and how he'd all mismanaged the thing. Then, having taken government, he has to do the big spend. But he's very happy to go to the world, to World Economic Forums, and say, "We're in great shape." And the only thing that's missing from that is thanks to the previous government.
Well, he would say thanks to the government before it rather than the previous government. He'd say thanks to Bob Hawke and Paul Keating rather than to John Howard. And when you look at the Howard reforms, the Howard economic reforms, they're not really so spectacular. I mean, take out the GST, an indirect tax which was brought in for the purposes of efficiency rather than fairness, and take out work choices, which is now, of course, being firmly dismantled. Where are the great economic reforms of the Howard times?
Kevin Rudd's an internationalist. We know that. You know, he speaks another language fluently. He speaks Mandarin fluently, and he
yeah,
seems
it's
to
a pity
be...
he doesn't speak English with the same ease.
Well, these detailed programmatic specificity. Yes. He speaks several languages. He's very comfortable in an international forum. How do you think he fares when it comes to Australian nationalism? Like, there's internationalism and there's nationalism. How does he straddle those two?
Well,
cultures?
I think he tries to combine them, Richard, and I think that's one of his strengths, that Howard had Australian nationalism, but it was a fairly narrow form of nationalism that was always symbolised by the little white picket fence which he tried to build around Australian society. Rudd doesn't walk away from that nationalism. He doesn't walk away from the idea of Australia as a strong, proud, independent country. But he wants to go further than that. He wants to reach out into the rest of the world and give Australia a place in the international community. And that's part of his national aspiration. And in that sense, he's very different from Howard. I mean, his nationalism was an exclusionary kind. Rudd's is inclusionary. Rudd wants to get out into the world and open Australia up to the world and the world to Australia. And I think he's managed to convey that change very successfully.
Do you think he's much of a leader? He doesn't really tend to go on the front foot on issues much, does he?
He tends to have an itinerary, but he tends not to want to get too far ahead. And I think in that he's looking at the great lessons of some of his predecessors. I mean, the two great exciting leaders that Labor has had over the post-war period were Gough Whitlam and Paul Keating.
He sees himself in more of the Bob Hawke tradition then, perhaps, than the...
Yes, I think he does. I think he sees himself as running a consensus, not trying to get too far ahead. And in that sense, he takes consensus to extraordinary lengths when he appoints people like Brendan Nelson and Peter Costello to high public office, which has alarmed a lot of his own people. But that's really the way he wants to be seen, as somebody who is not tribal in the way that the Labor Party traditionally has been. He can lead when he needs to. I mean, I think the leadership he gave in handling the global financial crisis, when he moved fast and hard, as Treasury advised him to, was an example of this. But a lot of the time, certainly, he does want to wait and make sure he gets it right. I think we're going to have to wait for the second term to see whether he really wants to lead in the way that I think he's capable of.
Mungo McCallum's here this morning, writer and journalist. His latest quarterly essay is called Australian Story, Kevin Rudd and the Lucky Country. You write that the left has obviously lost its dream of socialism over a long, painful, slow death from the 50s, really, if you like, culminating in the fall of the Berlin Wall. You say that the right has lost its dream of neoliberalism, and there's been a kind of a corresponding loss of faith there, that no one knows what to believe anymore?
Yes, I think that's true. That you remember after the death of socialism was officially announced with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Francis Fukuyama, an American economist, wrote a book called The End of History. And by that he meant that political history had come to an end, capitalism was now totally triumphant, there was no risk of anything, any more dispute about it. And of course, when Lehman Brothers collapsed at the end of 2008, and we suddenly had this entirely new thing spread out before us, that the wheels appeared to have fallen off the whole idea of the unfettered free market as well.
Is that a bit simplistic? I mean, we never had the kind of decadent capitalism that the United States had.
Yes, but that's where the fall really came, in the United States. I mean, the crash of capitalism in the United States was precisely comparable to the crash of socialism in Russia.
We had a free market economy running in Australia, but with much better, you know, prudential oversight of the economy. And we weren't really hit at all. We've only sort of copped what's happened overseas. It's nothing that's been homegrown in that. Has it really invalidated that kind of Francis Fukuyama free market plus democracy equals the end of history?
Well, yes, because the Americans, the home of the free market, as you say. That's where the collapse came. That's where you had the motor industry running cap in hand to the government saying, please bail us out. This whole, the horror of free market capitalism has always been government intervention. and suddenly the free market capitalists had to go and implore the government for money. I mean, that is the end of that concept. Now, nobody's arguing that capitalism per se is dead, but what people are arguing is that the neoliberal approach, the one that Rudd's criticised so vehemently in his essays, that is no longer a tenable position to have. OK, Australia never really had it, but now there's no chance we're going to keep moving in that direction which we had been in the past.
Writer and journalist Mungo McCallum is here this morning. His latest quarterly essay is called Australian Story, Kevin Rudd and the Lucky Country. There's another aspect of Kevin Rudd that's worth talking about, perhaps, and that's his ruthlessness. He knocked over John Howard to begin with. Brendan Nelson didn't seem to trouble him too much. Interestingly, I think maybe we saw an interesting side in Kevin Rudd in his ruthless pursuit and destruction of Malcolm Turnbull. I mean, Malcolm Turnbull's own party helped him with that. Do you just want to tell me a bit if you see that side of Kevin Rudd?
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, as I said at the beginning, he has got the fire in the belly. There's no doubt about that. And like all politicians, he believes that he is right and everybody else is wrong, and that he is the one who, for the good of the country, of course, indeed for the good of the world, for the good of humanity, he has to prevail.
He's quite different from Kim Beazley in that sense too.
Yes, but well,
my opponents are honest people with genuine disagreements. We all want what's best for Australia.
Oh, yes, and Rudd is prepared to acknowledge his opponents and, as I mentioned, even appoint them to high government office.
Well, once he's beaten them.
Once he's beaten them. And I think with Malcolm Turnbull, he felt that he and Malcolm Turnbull did basically agree on climate change and an emissions trading scheme, and that therefore, in a sense, he didn't have to beat Malcolm so severely because he had Malcolm slightly in his pocket. But as it turned out, of course, Malcolm's own party did the job for him. I mean, I would certainly not want to be Rudd's political enemy because I know he'd show very little mercy as a result of it. But then that's the way most successful politicians have been. The ones who don't have that killer instinct, the ones like Kim Beazley or Andrew Peacock, for instance, they're the ones who never become Prime Minister.
I go on the ABC's Unleashed website. Bob Ellis, who's of the left, like yourself, has written an essay on the defeat of Malcolm Turnbull. I just want to quote him here because he chastises Kevin Rudd and Penny Wong for their role in the defeat of Malcolm Turnbull. I just want to quote him here. He says, Rudd and Wong's unending and cruel gamesmanship, tormenting and humiliating an opposition they should have been gently wooing, preferring lordly, sadistic, onrushing deadlines to democratic discourse, jeering at their foes' understandable divisions rather than crafting honest policy, preferring the monkey tricks of municipal politics to wise, inclusive consensus on the most important problems since the Ice Age. What do you think of that?
Well, Bob's never been one to understate the issues, has he? I think that it's true that perhaps it would have been in Rudd's best interests to have supported Malcolm Turnbull and made sure he stayed on as leader of the opposition. A, because he was going to be very easy to beat at the next election, but B, because that there was the chance that he could get some sort of consensus on climate change going. But unfortunately, real politics doesn't work like that. I mean, you can't assume that you can, you know, leave your opponent with strengths and encourage your opponent to become stronger. Essentially, you've got to squash him. I mean, if I can go back quite a long way.
Even if it defeats your own ETS?
Well, even if it defeats your own interest in every way. I mean, if I can go back a long way, when Gough Whitlam was up against Billy Snedden, he crushed Billy Snedden without mercy, and as a result he got Malcolm Fraser as his opponent, and we all know what happened then. And at the time, people were telling Gough, no, treat Snedden gently, treat him gently, you need him. But it's just not the way politics works, and particularly not the way Parliament works. The stage of Parliament is such that leaders have to assert themselves and assert themselves as strongly as possible to keep their own followers happy. You're not allowed to be nice in Parliament except when you're saying goodbye for the Christmas break.
What do you think that says about Australia? It's commented by many people, international observers, that Australian Parliament, and our federal Parliament, is one of the most combative parliaments in the world.
I mean, I
think there are probably just as much hatred in the U.S. Congress and maybe even in the Palace of Westminster. But the way it's conducted is such bad, cheap theatre in Australia. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think in Australia, party politics has always been much a sharper division in Australia than in many countries. It started as a very sharp division in England, but over the years it mellowed. What also has something to do with it is that the Australian Parliament tends to be a fairly small parliament. There's not much time between elections, and parties very seldom have a big majority. So the combative aspect, there's never really time to cool off between elections, and there's never really the luxury of total domination of the parliament to be able to cool off. But also, I suppose it is that the Australian Parliament's always been rough. At one stage in New South Wales, they genuinely proposed setting up a boxing ring in the grounds of Parliament House so that members could settle their differences outside. Admittedly, that was in colonial times, but you can imagine it being appropriate now.
Oh, indeed. An interest in politics would just skyrocket, wouldn't
yes.
it? It'd be fantastic. Mentioning it then, it was saying, within that very combative arena that is federal parliament, Kevin Rudd, Penny Wong couldn't resist the destruction of Malcolm Turnbull. Well, their
because
role in the destruction because he was there.
Mm.
Has that then showed a failure of leadership from Kevin Rudd and Penny Wong, though? Because here they are about to institute the most important reform of their... I mean, I don't really think, no matter how long they're in government, they're going to introduce anything that's as significant or attempt to introduce anything that's as significant as an ETS. It's now that it's fallen down, for the moments anyway, it's revealed a kind of a hole where they haven't bothered to explain or take the Australian people into their confidence.
Indeed, that's quite
true. To lead on this matter.
That's quite true, and one of the reasons they didn't was they thought they had Malcolm Turnbull in their pocket. They thought that Malcolm was going to support the ETS, as indeed he did, and, of course, they thought that he'd be able to deliver his party behind him, as he didn't. And as a result, the deniers, the sceptics, the rent seekers, the self-interested and the sheer bloody-minded moved in. And then public opinion has changed. Public enthusiasm has softened greatly for the idea of action on climate change. Now, that is Rudd's fault and Wong's fault. They should not have abandoned the ring. They should have kept out there selling it. And now, of course, with Abbott, a genuine naysayer, in charge of the opposition, now Rudd and Wong are going to have to get out there and start selling it hard to the public, and they will. That's possibly the only good thing that's come out of the events of the last couple of weeks.
Jack Lang famously gave Paul Keating some very good advice, which is to test the character of metal of any politician. Watch how they treat people in service industries, taxi drivers, waiters. Mm-hmm. Kevin Rudd famously shouted at a flight attendant. He holds his own staff hostage in the building, keeps them away from their families. But then there's Kevin Rudd who is, I think we have to say, authentically concerned about the plight of homeless people and real
Indeed.
Poverty in Australia. How do you reconcile those two, Mungo?
Well, I think there are, in a sense, two Kevin Rudds. There's Kevin Rudd, the political activist, and there's Kevin Rudd, the family man, human being, soft touch. He can be very difficult and very abrasive and very rude. He doesn't suffer fools gladly. He does lose his temper and has that other Australian characteristic of having a very fine vocabulary when he does. But there is the very soft side, the visits to the homeless anonymously at weekends and so on. And there is his very... he is a committed Christian, who believes in things like the parable of the Good Samaritan very, very strongly. It's always hard for an active politician to reconcile those two sides. And most successful politicians have that, if you like, dichotomy about them.
Are you optimistic about the future, Mungo?
Not madly at the moment. I really think with climate change, I think we've left it too late. And that we are now in deep trouble, and nothing we do now is going to change that, and we're probably not going to do very much anyway. So I think that's not a matter for great optimism. But I do feel that at a sort of day-by-day level within a country like Australia, it's hard to be too pessimistic. I mean, we've got a great the past of a stable democracy. We've worked towards being a fairer and more just society for a very long time. On the whole, we've avoided the kind of internal strife and bickering. And we are one of only two examples in human history of a consciously multicultural society. We've made ourselves so deliberately rather than had it thrust upon us. The other, of course, being the United States after World War I. And I think those are all reasons for optimism. And, on the big issues, sometimes I think we're just not up to it.
Mungo, great to see you again. Good to know you can still drink with your left hand, though, because if you can still raise a schooner with your left hand, things aren't too bad, I suppose.
That's absolutely right, Richard.
Great to see you again, Mungo. Thank you for being my guest in conversation today.
Thanks, mate.
Mungo McCallum, and his quarterly essay is called Australian Story, Kevin Rudd and the Lucky Country.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
And now here's a conversation I had earlier this year with shelter designer Jeannie Madden. Jeannie Madden was working as a schoolteacher a few years ago when she watched a documentary on homeless people. And instead of thinking, oh, how terrible, and perhaps donating some money, she decided she was going to do something more practical to address the problem. So she invented the Street Swag. The Street Swag is a light, practical and portable swag that can be rolled up and used as a bag during the day. It doesn't put a roof over your head, but it will protect you from a cold, hard concrete surface and keep your stuff safe. Well, Jeannie's received plenty of accolades and awards, and just a few weeks ago, she was named Queensland finalist in the 2010 Young Australian of the Year Awards. But when we spoke, all Jeannie really wanted to do was to make more swags. Jeannie Madden, good morning.
Hi, thank you for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure, and you brought your swag in. It's quite smart, actually, I must say. It's a fashion item now. Describe how it works, Jeannie.
Okay, so you've got a high-density foam mattress in waterproofed canvas that rolls down into itself to be a bag or backpack, but you've also got a cover sheet that comes up over the top of you to be a waterproofed blanket to keep you warm and camouflaged during the night.
And keep the rain off you pretty well too, as you say.
Yeah, with the waterproofing, the rain just beads off you, so you can sleep in wet garden beds or on the concrete and still be quite warm and comfortable.
And as you say, it rolls up and it's quite a lightweight carry bag. And why is that aspect of it important, the idea of it being a carry bag?
It was important that it didn't look like bedding. So if you're homeless, the last thing you want, particularly if you're a woman or a child, is to be shown to be homeless. You know, you may as well have a great big neon sign on the back of you saying, you know, I'm homeless, you know, do terrible things to me, because that's what happens. So just for security as well as dignity, it was important that it didn't look like bedding. And that's one of the reasons why it has been so successful.
You know, it's one of those things that's so simple and clever. It's like putting wheels on luggage. You know, once they sort of appeared, you go, why didn't anyone think of this before? I mean, it's clever and it's elegant and it's simple and it's amazing. How much does it cost to make, and is it easy to make?
They cost us about $60 each to make, and that's just basically cost of materials. They're made by prisoners up in Woodford and down in Grafton, who actually get a Certificate 3 in textile fabrications. They love the project. They love being a part of it. We also have a community out in Alice Springs who make them as part of a CDEP, so kind of like the interventions version of Work for the Doll, and they make them for themselves and their own families. The design, part of the design was that it had to be super simple to sew. So it should take an unskilled person about 10 minutes to sew. And then the boys at Nudgee College put the foam in and rolled them up.
It's the very essence of good design. It's one of those things that, well, it is, because it's very simple, and yet it's multi-purpose, and you use, you know, great quality and components as part of it. It's just, it's very impressive. It's elegant in a funny sort of way.
Oh, thanks. maybe it was my swagger as I walked in.
Maybe it was. I don't know. Tell me how you started working with homeless people. How did you first come into contact with homeless people, Jeannie?
I started as a volunteer with one of the local street vans when I was only about 17, and probably 16, and I was probably a little too young. as a young girl going out on the street at night. That was a pretty scary experience. And I did that for a number of years, and I was always connected with the different charities who were working with homeless. So it wasn't any surprise to anyone when I decided to get everyone who was sleeping rough in Brisbane a swag for Christmas. No one was surprised, least of all my family. But then, of course, we worked out that the traditional swag wasn't going to cut it because it was too heavy, too big, and it looked like bedding. So that's why the design was born out of necessity.
This was, I mentioned in, before that this was sort of born out of watching a documentary. Tell me about watching that documentary and how that idea unfolded from that.
The documentary was an ABC documentary, actually.
Yes.
I don't think it exists anymore. But they sent reporters out on the street to sleep rough for the weekend. And what they found, their conclusion was that it wasn't so much food that was an issue. It was not being able to get a good night's sleep. And they talked about just how fast a downhill spiral that is, not being able to get sleep. So on your mental health, but also on your physical health. So,
and your appearance too. You know, if you've been sleeping rough, you look like it too, don't you? That makes you kind of unemployable, Jeannie.
And there's plenty of people today trying to hold down a job, but not being able to get a good night's sleep, it becomes very difficult. And you can see why it is such a fast downhill spiral. So I just felt, well, that's not good enough. We're not a third world country. You know, for crying out loud, I can get them a jolly swag, literally. So that's what we set about to do. And I spoke to my husband about it, and we said, even if we have to sell the car, this is something that we'll do. It was a 1966 MGB I wanted to sell anyway. I still haven't sold it. I'd like to sell it. So if anyone's listening. We still have the car.
So how did you afford to do this? How did you afford to actually go and buy these swags?
The original idea was that we would go out and buy the swag.
Camping swag.
Yeah. But within about 24 hours of toying with that idea, we realised it wasn't going to work.
Why not?
It was too heavy, too big, it just wasn't practical on the street. So what we did was I had a friend who was working for Brisbane Extra at the time, and we took some footage of some trial ones that my mum had made, full-size ones, and we got people who were sleeping on the streets feedback, and we aired that, and we just had such a great response from the people of Brisbane wanting to look after their own community. And that's when the prison up at Woodford got on board, and the prisoners made that first 200 for that Christmas.
You had to move out of your home, though, didn't you, at one point?
I won't say I wasn't working because, you know, I was working pretty hard, but not being in the paid workforce is difficult and can be difficult. So I still teach one day a week up at Stewart Home, a boarding school in Brisbane, and they are incredibly supportive of me. But yeah, we put tenants in, and we're so lucky to have such a supportive family.
So you downscaled your lifestyle to be able to afford to get this thing up and running, Jeannie, pretty much.
Yeah, but I didn't think much of it at the time. So we still had somewhere to live. You know, that's better than the people that we are doing this for. So it was nothing in comparison.
So you trialled these street swags, these new designs, because the camping ones weren't appropriate for living in the street, and you created your first couple of swags. How did you do that? Can you sew? Did you do this yourself?
I'm a pretty rotten sewer. I can hand stitch, and the first couple I made using felt as the what would be the mattress, and I made them about Barbie size as I
Prototypes,
yeah. And, you know, I had my year 11 students up against the board, and I'm taking their heights and their measurements. And so I stitched the first little tiny ones, and then my mum made the first 50 full-size ones, which was a bit difficult because with the canvas, you need an industrial sewing machine to sew. So my poor mother, who's a fabulous sewer, took over, and I'm very grateful to her, and she's remained as the chairperson of the board for Street Swags now, so I couldn't have done anything without Mum.
So, Jeannie, having made these first ones, did you then try them out? You tried them out with people on the street, and then did you start taking feedback from them?
Yeah, that's what we did. One particular fellow who's well loved in Brisbane and then in Sydney, a fellow named Tony Tarasenko, who we still keep on our website. He was one of the first to trial them and give us his feedback. And some of the feedback that we got was that they wanted them in camouflage colours. They wanted them with a thinner mattress, so it was easier to roll up. We took on that feedback, and that's what we produced for them. Tony actually very sadly passed away last year, but we keep him on the website because he is so special to me and so special to so many of us. What Tony really taught so many of us here is just his sense of generosity and his sense of responsibility to those less fortunate. Every time we gave him a street swag, he kept giving it away to someone he felt was less fortunate than himself. This is a man who had nothing. And
he was a man who once had everything too, didn't he?
Yeah, he actually played football for Australia.
When you say football, do you mean rugby league or soccer or Australian rules football?
I think it must have been rugby union.
Okay.
Back then, he was a pretty old man. So.
And what went wrong?
He did become mentally ill and he lost his job, and it was at that point that he lost his family. But he has been taking his, you know, he was very good at taking his medication. He never drank or took any drugs or anything like that. But he was one of those people in Brisbane and then again in Sydney who took care of everyone else on the street. He was... you know, when someone was first homeless in Brisbane, you know, we're talking 5 years ago up here in Brisbane, so things have changed a lot now. The face of homelessness is very different now in Brisbane. But back then, he was the guy who you'd go to find out where the showers were and where you could get something to eat. So that sense of looking after everyone else, he was just such an incredible person. We just have so much to learn from him.
Do you see many children on the streets, Jeannie?
Richard, it makes me sick. It makes me so angry and it makes me so sick. How many small children are sleeping in our street swags now? I've got goosebumps and I feel like crying just sitting here telling you this. A couple of weeks ago, I put a street swag on the back of a 4-year-old little girl and had to pull her little golden curls out so they didn't pinch on the strap. And just touching her, physically putting it on her, knowing what her life was and imagining what she has ahead of her really, really upset me. These days, it's the majority of people sleeping in our street swags are families with children. That's what I was saying about the face of homelessness has changed so much, particularly since the financial crisis. These days, it's children. That particular child is sleeping in a particular park in Brisbane City with another 5 children and their 2 mothers, and the older children are still going to school.
It's still deeply shocking to hear these stories, and most people don't really see this happen. We don't see it happen. Tell me how the family dynamic works in these cases, families fighting hard to stay together.
Well, that's it. You're not going to see them because these people know they'll have their children taken away from them. So you're not going to see them in the media. You're not going to see them registered as being homeless. This mother, because I'm such a hard-crusted cow after doing this for 5 years, that I have a policy that they have to sign for the street swag themselves and they can't sign for anyone else. And signing it, you know, they agree that they're only going to get one and they have to look after it. So, you know, I had said no to this woman, and it was Homeless Connect here.
Well, she came for a second one to you. Is that what it was?
Well, she said, could she take one for her child? And I said no, because I'm so tough that they only ever go to those people genuinely sleeping rough. And this was one of those events where some people tend to take advantage of it and come in to get free stuff. So, you know, I was turning away about 2 in 3 people on this particular day. Anyway, she actually smuggled this little girl that I was telling you about in to sign for her street swag. And I was, like I was saying, I was just so devastated. And of course I said, oh, and here's one for your little boy who's still at school. Don't bring him back. But you know, she is just one of so many that I see. The 2 little girls also that day, one was 14 and one was 15, both in their 3rd trimester of pregnancy, who I had to show how to roll up the swag using their knees. And you know, they were one of six pregnant women that I showed that day.
My guest at the moment is Jeannie Madden, who is the designer of the Street Swag. Jeannie, how do you get them to people? You're obviously there in situ, distributing them yourself on occasion. How do you get them to people who need it?
We work with everyone who works with homelessness right across Australia. So all the big guys, St Vincent de Paul, Salvation Army, Mission Australia, Wesley Mission, but all the little guys as well, hospitals, schools, church groups, basically every man and his dog across Australia. So I'm in a very privileged position in that I get to see a very good idea and a very good picture of what is actually going on, what is the truth of what's going on out there at the moment.
Yeah, what's the truth as you see it?
The truth is more families, more drugs, but mostly more families. Since the financial crisis, the centres that I deal with, so that's the emergency accommodation. So when they can't accommodate someone, they say, sorry, we're full, here, have a street swag. Those centres are turning away between 6 and 8 times what they were last year. So a couple of the centres down the road here turn away more than 80 families a week.
Things have gotten much worse in the last year or so.
Yeah, well, you know, people have lost their jobs. They can't pay the rent. Rents are so high that they end up on the street, particularly families. They're the ones who are doing it so tough. I don't know about yourself. You know, obviously you work for the ABC. It's not Channel 10 wages, but...
I'm not on the street.
Yeah, no. But what I'm saying is, if you were to lose your job, how far off would you be? You know, how much have you got in savings? What if your wife lost her job as well? Or, you know, your wife wasn't working because she was looking after the kids. Really, how close is it that we are all living on the wire? Really, we're talking the vast majority of people in Australia. So those people who have lost their job, it's no wonder that we are seeing the numbers we're seeing.
When the current Prime Minister was elected, he made what was obviously a very sincere remark about his intention to do something about the plight of homeless people. Are you seeing more activity from government agencies to pitch in and offer help for homeless people who are in strife, Jeannie?
I hate saying anything political because I work with everyone, but the answer is no.
They could be doing more.
Some of the centres who we work with extremely closely who are building, in the process of building, and that funding was about building. I spoke to one of them a couple of days ago, a centre, Families Back on Track. They're building an incredible centre to break the cycle of homelessness. This is St Vincent de Paul. And the fellow who is running it down there, I asked him that specific question and he said he has been told it will be at least 7 years. So the street swags are about keeping people alive in the meantime. And I've been in the industry long enough to not be holding my breath. So this is keeping people alive.
Jeannie, what's the demand like for the street swags?
Well, we've done now about 12,000 across Australia, and I know that we're not even coming close to a sniff of scratching the surface on how many people actually need these. And don't forget, I'm tough. They only go to those people genuinely sleeping rough. So they have to be sleeping outside. They can't be in a hostel or temporary accommodation.
How were you called to help in families who were affected by the Victorian bushfires? Tell me that story.
The fires hit on a Saturday, and it was the following day, the Sunday, that the salvos down in Victoria turned up at my girlfriend's place in Melbourne because they knew she had a stock of them. So they picked up 100 that day. And then on the Tuesday afternoon, about 3:30, I had a phone call from the salvos in the Seymour region. How fast could we get another 300 down there? So I called Nudgee College, who mobilised their entire boarding school. So by 8:30 that night, we had 400 street swags packed with blankets and pillows on pallets, ready to be picked up by StarTrack the next morning. And then the girls at Stuart Home College started making hygiene packs to put in them. So toothbrush and toothpaste and those kind of essentials. So it was an incredible community response.
Because they're easy to make. And that was the whole point of the design, wasn't it?
That's right. So, you know, it would be great if we could have a few stocks for emergency relief.
Jeannie Madden's here this morning. She's the designer of the Street Swag, which is being distributed to the many thousands of homeless people across the whole of Australia now. Now, Ginny, what sort of initiatives are you involved in that will actually get people off the streets? You're involved in a few, aren't you?
Yeah, well, this particular one down at Arundel with St. Vincent de Paul is something that I've been keeping my eye on for quite a long time with John Milsom down there. And that is about, it's intensively supported accommodation. So basic education, basic skills that people need to survive out there, how to feed a family on a budget. But not just those things. It's about linking all the services that are already there to deliver them to these people in a very intensively supported way. The program then will go on to be, it'll have two more tiers of different levels of support. So once they finish the program there for about 18 months, they then still remain under the care of St. Vincent de Paul in various steps. So I'm now involved in some research to get that up and running in Brisbane. St. Vincent de Paul, I have been told, I don't know if John Campbell's out there listening, but I'll be meeting with him in October because I know that they're very serious about this and they're very keen to see these centres roll out up the coast of Queensland. So where we are working very hard to get this happening, but you know, the reality is these people who we're looking at trying to support, if it wasn't for the street swag, would be dead by then. So my idea is to keep the maximum number of people alive until we as a community can start getting these people back on their feet.
Ginny, the street swag has won a lot of accolades and awards, and you've got the People's Choice Awards and the New Inventors. And you're about to head off for the finals of the Index Award for the street swag. What is the Index Award?
It's the largest design awards in the world. And I don't look at myself as a designer. Certainly, I didn't go into that.
You're a part-time teacher who does some stuff on the side.
I know, and I have a master's in theology. So it's kind of a coup to be the only Australian finalist. But it's patroned by Prince Frederik in Denmark. So that's where the start of the world tour begins. So I will be heading over there in a couple of weeks, which will be very exciting. And certainly I would love to win. I think we could use that prize money very well.
Indeed. It's a big deal because the prize money is very substantial. It's 100,000 euros. Wow, that's great.
I don't really think I have that much chance of winning. Like I said, I'm not a designer. My design is extremely simple.
But that's the essence of good design. That's the whole point. Simplicity, effectiveness, you know, great materials, all that. You've got all that. I don't see why you wouldn't
feel like I deserve it, though. But it is a great accolade for the design just to be a finalist.
And Ginny, you're dealing with a very big problem here, and obviously you're very passionate, and you seem to be becoming more passionate. Are you able to, you know, give yourself some space and a bit of time here? Because you can't live with this day and night, can you?
I do, and I have, and you know, of course there have been times, and I was very sick with when I had my baby with my pregnancy, and you know, there were times when I would have loved to have given up, but I don't feel I can, because my problems are never as bad as those people who I'm dealing with.
It's not a matter of giving up, it's a matter of taking a holiday once in a while.
Oh, sure, but the need is so much bigger. You know, I can't say, you know, to one little boy, look, here's your street swag, but your sister can't get one because I can't be bothered anymore. I can't do that. And people who can, well, here's cheers to them.
It's a great design. There's obviously demand is outstripping supply very heavily for the street swags. You do need help. How can people donate to help create more street swags for homeless
Please,
people?
Please, that is what we need. You know, I know there's a lot of charities out there now who need donations. You know, it's wonderful that we do have some good supporters, but we desperately do need donations. $60 buys one street swag for one person. If people could get on our website, that would be fantastic. streetswags.org. We're also in the phone book.
Streetswags, streetswags.org. That's simple. It's nice. And like your street swag itself. Fantastic to meet you, Jenny.
And thank you so much.
Congratulations on the amazing work you've done and a beautiful, simple idea that can take over the world.
Thanks, Richard.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
And for the record, Jeannie's Street Swags did win the People's Choice Award at the 2009 Index Awards.
On ABC Local Radio, Conversations with Richard Feidler.